From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High is John. Say hello, John.
Yeah, boy. Hello.
Call me Snake. Yeah.
Trying to go back to 96 here. Trying to get back into that mentality.
Trying to get back in that. What did the kids say in 96?
I don't know. They weren't saying chill. That was 80s.
They weren't saying hella yet. That was like aughts, right?
No. God, we had no culture. Who was big? Limp Bizkit?
Limp Bizkit popped around that. Yeah. 96 was like when Korn hit. That's
right.
When Limp Bizkit hit.
Well, I've never listened to in my life.
Which one, Korn or Limp Bizkit?
Well, I've never listened to Korn. I have heard Limp Bizkit involuntarily.
It's hard to escape Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, the Nookie. I was always hearing that song, the Nookie.
Yeah, yeah. Always
and
liked.
And then Garo would walk around singing that song in Laser Craze Boss's voice.
You know, if it's a Nookie, I gotta get the cookie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the 90s to me.
Did Limp Bizkit sound like the Ramones?
No,
no,
not at all.
Not at all.
I think Laser Craze Boss listened to him, though. I think he just liked anything. He was really into Godsmack. You would go over to his place.
Because
they were local. They were, you know, in Boston, they were local. So if you went to his place, like, he had these Cambridge Soundworks speakers around his house and stuff, and you were just hearing Godsmack all the time. You were
so, yeah.
He would drag on a cigarette and go, Godsmack! I love this.
Yeah. Godsmack was all right. But, you know, it's that kind of post-grunge, Alice in Chains worship. I think their name
It never clicked with me. It never really clicked with me.
I saw them live. I saw Godsmack live at a festival, and they're awesome live.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they're fantastic live. I have no doubt.
But I got to tell you, if I had an opportunity to see Limp Bizkit live, I would totally take it, especially since Fred Durst is dressing like... He's dressing like Boomer Dad now.
Yeah, what the hell's going on there?
That's like his new thing. He's like,
well, I guess he looks stupid. If you dress like he used to, he looks stupid.
Yeah. So oh yeah, the red hat and.
So they're kind of doing the Weezer thing. They're doing the Weezer where they look like nerds, but then they rock really hard or something.
Yeah. Well, Wes Borland, their guitar player, has always done the thing where he dresses like a monster, or some sort of creature. You know, he's the weird artsy guy in the band, and he's the one who will never age because he's never just Wes Borland out on the stage.
Right.
And he said he wanted to do creature effects for movies, and playing in a band was just something he was doing and wasn't taking seriously.
Right.
And then it took off, and he was kind of disappointed with it because he didn't really care much for the music they were playing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he said he just wasn't into it. And he said, I left the band because three things happened. One, a fan was killed at a show in Australia, and he said that kind of landed the wrong way. He said 9/11 happened. And then and then Maynard from Tool compared us to McDonald's in an interview.
There's probably a little more to it than that.
Yeah, I know. It's just funny. But that was clearly the worst thing. But you know, he's back in that band. But yeah, he's probably people would always go, oh, I don't like Limp Bizkit, but Wes Borland, he's pretty good, you know.
Yeah, I only heard the Nookie song and Garo's version of it.
Yeah,
and Crazy Boss's voice. That's all I really heard.
Their first album was kind of fun because it was really over the top, angry, and really it felt
your age though.
Yeah, oh, big time. It was my age group, like. Everyone had Significant Other in their CD wallet. Everyone had Korn's Follow
CD
the Leader.
CD wallet.
Yeah.
Boy, are we 90s now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had our CD wallet, which had it had Korn's Significant Other. You had to have like Limp Bizkit's Limp Bizkit's Significant Other. And gosh, what were some other ones from that time?
Kid Rock.
Kid Rock. Oh, that Kid Rock album with Ba with Da Ba. And
Laser Craze Boss, love that he had us listen to it on the way to ChillerCon.
Primus, like anti-pop, or pork soda,
right? Goldfinger. Do you have any Goldfinger Scott?
Big time. We had Goldfinger, Less Than Jake.
Less Than Jake.
Yeah,
they're pretty good.
Yeah, I like Less Than Jake, man. They put out a new one recently, and I bought it. You know. Takes me back. That 90s ska sound just washes over me, and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember when all
no
music
doubt
like
when
this.
You had a girl in the car.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And like early No Doubt was like full on ska, so it was kind of cool, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I saw them just as they were getting big, because I bought I love their ska stuff I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a ticket when nobody had really heard of them, and then that Just a Girl song blew up huge. And I went to the Mamakin Club in Boston that night. It was packed. It had sold out. And the ska kids were confronted with all these frat boys who were there.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody, so they were yelling, the frat boys were yelling, No Doubt, No Doubt. And then one of the ska kids went, Hootie! So, you know, because I think the Hootie Million Man March sketch had aired on SNL that weekend or something. I didn't see it, but heard about it. And it was a good show, though. They were really good live. To see them in a small club like that was great.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you see a band right when they're popping. And that happened to me with Maroon 5. They came and played at my college right when they had that Songs About Jane album that every song was like top 10, you know.
Right. Well, I saw the Dixie Chicks as they were popping.
Mm.
In 98.
Yeah, I remember when they were a local band in Dallas. Like,
wow,
you know, like my parents' age listened to them, and we had the first CD in our house when they were a 4-piece, and the music was much, it was before Natalie Maines joined the group.
Right. So that was the early, like allegedly superior version.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was
like,
a little more
after
straight
that,
country.
They became a they were a record company band by the time she joined, and you know, then she went for the cheap heat in England and killed their career.
Yeah. Well, she decided to piss on her audience, and that
it's like, I don't know why you would do that. It's like, you could say you're against the war or whatever, but you don't make it like a cheap heat thing in England.
Yeah.
And what I thought was funny was they were acting like, well, you know, we're gonna make this comeback, and every song was like, we hate you. Fuck you, rednecks, and, you know, the hell with you, piss on you, piss on Texas, you know. And it was kind of excused. It was like, oh, they're making this comeback. And the funny thing was, I think their record sales were garbage because they had lost the country fans, who were the only people who still bought CDs,
mm-hmm.
you know, and could be faithful fans. And then they had acquired these new fans who actually didn't want to listen to them.
Yeah.
You know, it was the Lilith Fair crowd. They're not going to listen to them. They don't like that music.
No, they don't. I mean, like, Dixie Chicks were heavily promoted by Rolling Stone. There were documentaries, but the people who read Rolling Stone don't like the Dixie Chicks.
Like their music. They don't like country.
It was purely political. And the Lilith Fair crowd, they like their politics, but no, they'd rather listen to like Poe or Sarah McLachlan or what's it called? The Indigo Girls, you know, that's more
Indigo Girls. That's their thing. And Shakespeare Sisters. And it's funny because they had a big concert planned for the Denver area back after that controversy, and they said it was canceled, and they tried to excuse it like, oh, the tour has to be rearranged or something. The thing is, their ticket sales were garbage.
Yeah.
Like, nobody was buying tickets. Like,
yeah,
no one cared.
And the faithful country fans, they alienated them, and they had a minute where all the teenage girls were listening to them. Because I remember when Fly came out and they had that Earl song.
Oh God!
Yeah, which was cringe. But
we're gonna have a spousal abuse story. Yeah.
But it was huge, and I remember being in speech class as a freshman, and a girl did a speech about the Dixie Chicks. You know, so that's how big they were. but this was before 9/11. You know, this was This was 99, so it was still the 90s.
Oh God. Yeah, basically the old spousal abuse story that's like a cliche in Incredible Hulk comic books.
Right, know? Right.
David Banner's sleeping on the couch and the wife is being abused.
Yeah.
He hulks out.
He hulks out to save her.
The abusive husband is wrong. Hulk no like mean husband.
So what were some other...
And they think that's unique, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's never been done. Who are some other 90s bands? You remember Filter? Do you remember...
Yeah, yeah, Filter.
Filter was...
Yeah, that was the same man I shot, right?
Yeah, Richard Patrick's brother. Robert Patrick's brother, excuse me. Richard Patrick.
Yeah, yeah. Richard Patrick, yeah. The Hey Man, I Shot's a great tune.
Hey Man, I Shot.
The X-Files episode.
Yeah, yeah. And Welcome to the Fold. Those are good. That's good stuff. I remember they, I think we talked about on the Spawn show, they did the Trip Like I Do song with Crystal Method. It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, they were good. I mean, that's some of the better 90s stuff right there is Filter. And yeah. God, there was some good bands, but there was a lot of one hit wonders and stuff like Catherine Wheel and stuff, and groups like that.
And I liked some of the bands that were ripping off Ministry, like Fear Factory, and I liked Static X, that first couple of Static X records. You know, I like some of that.
I heard they were good. I've never listened to them. I heard they were good. I just never listened to them.
Yeah, the first Static X album is wild. It's crazy. But and Fear Factory's Obsolete, that's like peak 90s metal. Right. I love that.
We have to remember back then, if you want to hear something, either your friend had a CD and you made an audio cassette.
Yep.
Or, you know, or you weren't going to buy this stuff blind. And, you know,
no,
your access to music was not as easy as it is now.
It was too expensive to do that. CDs were like $20, you know.
Yeah. No CD copying back then, you know. It's like it was terrible. Like, so I was real selective, and back then I was buying a lot of old punk rock stuff, like from the late 70s and early 80s, like stuff I just missed out on when I was a kid. So, and that stuff was coming out left and right from like Rhino Records and other labels. So I was more into the Stooges while everybody else was, you know, into Kid Rock or whatever.
The Stooges.
Yeah, you know, I liked some of the Britpop groups I liked. Oasis.
I liked Blur. I never had any Oasis CDs until later, but I liked the stuff I heard. I liked all that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I dig that stuff, and a lot of those bands I thought sounded cool.
Yeah.
Like, but didn't buy a lot of it because they were still too expensive.
Well, the reason we're talking about the 90s is the movie we're doing today is Escape from L.A. We were going to have Eric on since this movie is based on his life.
Right.
But I wanted to do this show because he said he liked this one more than Escape from New York.
Oh, you'd have to explain that.
Yeah. Yeah. But he dropped out at the last minute. Eric, you know, I guess the internet went out at the Cecil Hotel or something.
Well, you know, L.A. right now, and I could say because I was there a couple of months back, is now the Escape from L.A. Los Angeles.
Yeah. They misjudged it by a few years, but it got there.
Yeah, he was off for a little while, but it's there.
So, you know, we were talking about 90s bands. The soundtrack for this is 90s. We got Stabbing Westward. We got Tool, and like early Tool, it's Sweat. we've got our man White Zombie. We got some Rob Zombie.
Of course.
Dallas band, the Toadies. Actually, a few Dallas bands. We got Toadies. We got Butthole Surfers. Butthole Surfers aren't Dallas. They're Austin, but Texas.
Yeah, Austin, Tex.
We got Sugar Ray. You know, Mark McGrath, Mark McLoaf. Mm-hmm. Gravity Kills, Tori Amos, Ministry, Orange 9mm. Ooh, here's this band, John, is Grateful Dead for meth heads. Clutch.
This is like walking into a Camelot music.
CIV, I don't know them. Sex Pod and Deftones. So very alternative and industrial metal, you know?
right.
And of course you got your score by John Carpenter, and who else was it? Shirley Walker. Not familiar with
that.
Yeah.
Who did all the cartoon music for Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, Yeah, it looks like she worked on Mask of the Phantasm.
I think she did that. She also worked on the original Batman soundtrack with Danny Elfman, I believe.
Heavy hitter.
Yeah, because I think Elfman can't conduct.
I wouldn't be surprised about
that.
Yeah,
like he actually can't read music or something. Like he didn't have enough experience to actually do the conducting. Something like that.
Well, he comes out of a weird art rock paradigm.
Yeah, Richard Elfman said they just handed Danny an instrument. He just started playing.
Yeah.
Like, no training. Like,
he's just one of those guys who just instinctually gets music.
He's a savant. He's a savant, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So Escape from LA. I missed this one when it was in the theater. I was too young.
I saw it twice.
Saw it twice? So you liked it when you saw it?
No, I wouldn't say I saw it twice because I like.
Why'd you see it twice then?
I went to a preview screening for Laser Craze employees. Mm. Or, well, we all got passes and we went, and it was one of those crowded screenings where a bunch of college kids were also there. And everybody there was an Escape from New York fan. And then I was just like, it's all right. But my coworkers hated it. But I just thought it was okay. It was mildly amusing. And then when I moved back to Mississippi, my little brother had not seen it. And I took him to see it. Because he was a big fan of Escape from New York, because he had watched my Laserdisc copy or whatever I had. And, you know, we would see it, and I still just thought it was okay. You know, it was, but it's disappointing, because it's not the sequel I wanted to see, you know, being a fan of the original film.
So you like the original film still? You haven't changed?
I do like the original film. I saw the original film when I was 10. And because back then, being a latchkey kid, you know, and I had this access to something like 5 different cable movie channels. Escape from New York played repeatedly. So I was able to watch it like 5 or 6 times in the October of 82. And 10 years old, I was a little too young to see it. It introduced me to the F word. But it introduced me to like Lee Van Cleef. I had not seen the Spaghetti Westerns yet at the time. Mm-hmm. I think I'd seen For a Few Dollars More. And that was it. It introduced me to character actors. Like, I realized who Ernest Borgnine was. Mm-hmm. And it was Harry Dean Stanton. It introduced me to him. I already knew of Kurt Russell because of the Disney movies. And but I thought it was unique because it was very atmospheric. And back when I didn't know what that word meant. And it kind of put you in that world. And Eric had described it as an action. It's like an action movie, sort of without action, or it's an action movie shot like a horror film.
Yeah.
So it has action, but it's not really an action movie. It's strange. It's like a weird, like the action plays more like suspense.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like an art house action movie in a way.
Yeah. It's really, and I often think it's because he doesn't have, okay. An Assault on Precinct 13 was such a low budget film. I felt like he came up with creative ways to do action scenes because he couldn't afford a stunt team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you do the shootouts and the stunts with clever angles and, you know, kind of weird photography and everything. You know, you see a shotgun fire, but, you know, you see a body fall, but it doesn't, you're not seeing like somebody fall off a building or some
right.
major stunt like that where you'd have to pay a stuntman. So I feel like he kind of carried that style into Escape from New York, although mm-hmm. it had cool stuff. Like when Snake Plissken fights people, he doesn't do real showy moves. He like does these quick, like street fighting martial arts moves that are just so quick you can barely tell what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a quick headbutt and then some weird elbow move or whatever. And but the weirdness and the comedy, I like the film. It somehow remained consistently rewatchable. Yeah. I watched it again in 96, and I still like the creativity and the atmosphere and how he got a lot out of nothing. You know, James Cameron worked on the effects crew, and everybody knows that. You know, but it's got a lot of work from a lot of guys who went on to bigger things. And it's very 1982. And when I watched Escape from LA, I didn't expect a remake. And I know some friends of mine excuse it, who are fans of this movie, excuse it. Well, it's like Evil Dead 2 compared to Evil Dead. It's like, but that's not what I wanted to see. I wanted to see more different types of adventures of Snake Plissken in this world. And this is almost like a scene-for-scene remake with the gimmicks changed and really bad CGI effects, which I mean, they're bad even for that time.
Yeah,
really bad.
This came out at the same time as Independence Day, which I'd rather watch this, but Independence Day's effects are, you know, far and away superior. It made this movie look kind of low rent by comparison.
It's a CD-ROM game. Mm-hmm. It looks like a CD-ROM. Like if you were going to do Escape from New York CD-ROM game, it would look like this.
Which makes it somehow more 90s when I watch it today.
Yeah, it does. It looks extremely 90s. I mean, it's funny because you look at Escape from New York, and I don't think 80s. I think 70s.
Yeah. It's
because he made everybody have long hair, and they kind of dress like they do in Assault on Precinct 13.
Lee Van Cleef has an earring.
Yeah. It's very 70s, and yet it was a 1982 release. Or 81, I'm sorry, 81 release. But it's really a 70s film, and this is very 90s. It was, you know, there was no attempt to make it anything different. That, like, everybody looks like they're in a grunge band. Even the guards, like Stacy Keach, looks like he belongs in a grunge band. And Michelle Forbes looks like a female singer for a grunge band.
Yeah.
It just screams 90s the whole time, and you got old burnout Peter Fonda as the surfer. And
hey, spar Steve out, Snake.
Yeah, it's Steve Buscemi. It's like in this movie, it's like nothing says 90s more than Steve Buscemi in a major supporting role.
Yeah, for sure. By the way, have you heard the conspiracy theory about Stacy Keach, his character in this?
No.
Okay.
Oh, so, you know, Mike Malloy, what he claims?
Yeah.
You want to run that down?
Yeah, so Mike Malloy... who did the Eurocrime documentary, close friend of the show.
Yeah.
We need to have him on, really.
Eventually.
It's kind of a crime we haven't. He wrote a book about Lee Van Cleef. He wrote a biography. And he heard that Escape from L.A. was happening. And he had his agent send a note to John Carpenter, asking if he was going to pay tribute to Lee Van Cleef, like maybe put in memory of Lee Van Cleef in it or something. He said, of course, yeah. I never heard anything. But then the equivalent of Lee Van Cleef's character is played by Stacy Keach. And what's his name? Malloy!
Commander Malloy.
Mac Malloy. Very close.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you wonder.
Makes you wonder. Also, definitely. I have never noticed this, but Paul Bartel is in this movie.
I just noticed him for the first time. I didn't notice him the two times I saw it in a theater, and maybe the one time I watched it on Laserdisc. I never noticed.
Yeah. Oh, you know what's another 90s thing? Freaking Leland Orser being in this movie.
Who is that?
He plays the dude who programs the disc to wipe out to use the EMP. He was in Seven. He was in Alien Resurrection.
I have wiped all these movies from my mind.
Oh, okay. Do you remember Seven at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
He's the dude who, like,
okay.
And he's like, you know, he always has a freak out scene, but he's one of those dudes who's in everything in the 90s and then just, I don't know where he is. I don't know what happened to him.
Weird. Well, you got Cliff Robertson, who was in his old man role phase. Towards the end, Valeria Golino playing a Muslim, just like a Muslim chick that Snake starts to look like he's falling for.
Yeah,
because I always have to have that. So she's got the Season Hubley role.
So
basically.
She's the girl who he meets and then she gets offed immediately.
In the original. There's a lot in here that's very 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 90s. I guess AJ Langer, who played Utopia. I guess she's had a pretty thriving TV career since, but I don't watch television, you know, barely anything on TV. So I haven't seen her in, but I thought she was good in this for that minor role. You have the whole idea. I guess Carpenter did this, what if Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority took over the country, or Pat Robertson?
Yeah, this movie's way more political than the original.
Yeah, and what I find so dumb about that, because I remember everybody in the Boston audience was just laughing condescendingly. And it's like, boy, if you want to know why its box office was bad, this is probably one of the reasons. And but I don't recall those types being all anti-drinking and smoking.
No, they were, you know, they used to be back way back.
Yeah.
You know, but
Prohibition, yeah, you could make that argument.
Exactly. But they were big on not doing that in their personal lives, but they kind of gave up on trying to police it. Because, you know, I remember the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, it was a dry neighborhood. Like, you couldn't buy booze nearby. But then
dry county, as
that's
they call it.
Yeah, that started to loosen up in the 90s, you know. So it was like they were remembering something. It's like a cultural memory of these people that wasn't really accurate to the day.
Yeah. And I mean, I was even back then, and I did not care about politics in a movie at all back then. I was just like, what the hell are they talking about? These people don't act like that.
And I did like that his daughter, when she, in the video on the plane, she's got a True Love Waits pin.
Yeah, yeah, that was pretty funny.
That was a big thing in the 90s, the purity culture and I Kiss Dating Goodbye and all this stuff.
Well, wasn't that a reaction to AIDS and the...
Yeah, I think it was, probably. That was a big moral panic. Was sexual purity.
If you're pushing AIDS hysteria, how do you expect people to react?
I know a guy who was attending Baylor in the 90s, and he said that the True Love Waits movement. He goes that whole thing. It made women who otherwise would have been nice, decent girls to date, like total weirdos. Not that they just wouldn't sleep with you, but that it was like, you know, I'm not even going to consider dating you unless, like, we're talking about marriage.
Unless it's courting.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it created this weird culture around dating that was strange.
Yeah, I imagine that had to be painful. I don't even know if dating still exists nowadays.
It's just all apps and swipe right and left.
I'm too old to know these days, but I'm too old and married to know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it just like, I met some guys who were in the Promise Keepers or whatever.
Promise Keepers. I've heard of this. Yeah. Is that?
Yeah. It's like these dudes who, I don't know if they're closet gay or something, but you know, super religious. And I don't know. I couldn't figure it out. I think I Google it, still couldn't figure it out. You know, I grew up Catholic, so I didn't.
Yeah, Catholicism kind of missed all that stuff.
Yeah.
It manifests itself in different ways in the Catholic Church, but you know, Catholicism, there'll be versions of that, but it's just looks completely different because the cultures
are so
different.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, I always say culturally German Irish Catholic in the South, so it was a different perspective on things.
Completely.
Like, we looked at the Baptists and we were like, oh, what a bunch of squares.
Yeah, yeah. I the few times I went to a Baptist church when I was a kid, it was a completely alien culture. Like, I didn't understand.
Yeah, they're very strange, very strange.
But yeah, that was a blast from the past when I saw that. And Cliff Robertson, I like that he doesn't have to go in and save his daughter. He has to go in and kill her.
Yes.
She's impure. She's probably had sex with Cuervo Jones.
Yeah, she's been banging Cuervo Jones.
Who looks like
six weeks of Sunday.
George Corifus, who is dressed like Che Guevara in this movie.
Yeah, totally intentional there.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I felt was more political about this movie, because the original Escape from New York, it's Snake versus just the corrupt system, right?
Yeah.
And he's the cool guy who rejects it and, you know, he humiliates the system at the end.
Right.
In this film, it's like Snake is caught between the wacky religious right and the wacky crazy left. That's all in this chaotic society in LA, which is like a hyper stylized version of just degenerate LA culture. Like Bruce Campbell's the Surgeon General of Beverly Hills.
yeah, exactly. And they got the weird facelifted nurses and stuff and assistants. So.
But one thing about this movie is, you know, you talked about the atmosphere in the original.
Yeah.
One thing about the original is that New York is kind of eerily empty in it. And so it seems kind of scary whenever Snake encounters someone. Like, it feels like there's a real threat. L.A. is way too crowded in this movie. Like, there's just people everywhere. It just feels like Snake's another dude walking through a crowd. You know, he's not sneaking through the streets.
Yeah, the danger is always there, but it's like gangs shooting each other, drive-by stuff. So obviously Carpenter put everything that annoyed him in this film. And in some ways, I think it makes for a kind of annoying movie. No, seriously. I mean, that's just the tone it's hitting. And because I don't, you know, that was the thing I noticed is very, you get those cool, quiet, tense scenes in the original. You have nothing like that here. None of the action can be taken seriously. None of the suspense can be, you know, none of the tension can be accepted as something you're reacting to, because there is none. You know, it's just kind of, okay, go to this point. This beat this character, then this character dies. Go to the. It's very episodic, you know.
To me it feels like it's just hitting the beats from the original. Because, like we said, it's sort of like Desperado, where it's a sequel, but not really.
Right.
But
he compared it to El Dorado, is what Carpenter was always.
Yeah. I think I said that when I wrote about it on Letterboxd. Because it is kind of like a Howard Hawks thing where he's just doing the same thing. But it acknowledges the New York stuff. So,
yeah,
it's kind of a sequel. But, you know, you have all the same characters. Instead of Cabby with Ernest Borgnine, you've got Map of the Stars Eddie with Steve Buscemi. That's
right.
You've got Stacy Keach instead of Lee Van Cleef. You know, you've got Cuervo Jones instead of the Duke of New York, which he's no Duke of New York. I'm sorry, you know.
No, not at all. Like, the Duke was scary, man. He was like, he was intimidating.
Yeah,
Isaac Hayes
is
great. And George Carfus is just there.
Yeah, yeah, just not much presence.
Yeah,
Pam Grier.
No gravitas.
Pam Grier playing a trans person.
yeah, she plays a trans or Z, which. Doesn't make much sense because it's kind of odd casting. I mean, it was
very
good to see
odd.
Her on, because we've seen her in Coffee and Foxy Brown, and she's just not going to, it's going to be tough for an experienced viewer to accept her as trans.
Yeah. 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 See, that was a very weird choice, I thought.
Yeah. She's dubbed with some dude's voice, and
right.
It just doesn't really work.
Yeah.
And it's got the trans humor. It's not really funny. Of course, you couldn't do it today.
No.
But it's not really funny or anything. There's a lot of gags in here you couldn't do today because it makes fun of the left, and they don't like that.
Yeah, makes fun of both sides. And to me, like, this felt more political because Snake is sort of the normal guy who's like, I don't like either of you people. You know, I don't.
Yeah.
And in fact,
he's supposed to be like the libertarian fence sitter.
Yes.
I think, you know.
And he's going to, instead of picking a side, he's just going to burn the whole thing down. At the very end, he just demolishes the world, basically. He commences the apocalypse.
Well, I think that's the first time I had seen the concept of what is the EMP or whatever, destroying all the electricity on Earth and everything. That's the first time. And I didn't think about it as anything real. I didn't know that they were really trying to come up with these weapons.
When I saw it, it seemed like sci-fi to me, but apparently it's not.
I wasn't reading my Tom Clancy books or anything, so I wasn't keeping up.
Tom Clancy could have done a commentary and just talked about how they were portraying it wrong the whole time.
Right. I don't even know if Carpenter did a commentary on the Laserdisc. I don't think he did.
I don't think he's done, dude. You know, you get the old two disc DVD of Escape from New York, and it's got Kurt Russell, it's got John Carpenter, it's got all of that.
Yeah.
You know, you get the Shout Factory Blu-ray. It's packed with special features. The Shout Factory Blu-ray of Escape from LA. It's got an interview with Stacy Keach and like. So a few people you've never heard of, and that's it, you know.
Weird.
Yeah, I think Carpenter just doesn't care about this movie.
Yeah, he didn't, because he did a commentary for Ghost of Mars with Natasha Henstridge that was more enjoyable than the movie itself, but...
Yeah.
I don't think he's proud of it at all.
Yeah, I don't think it landed the way he wanted, because he hasn't done anything for any DVDs or if somebody out there has seen some, if there's some weird German release that has a commentary, I'd love to know about it. Cause
Yeah.
Every release of this has been pretty bare bones. The best ones, the Shout Blu-ray, and that one doesn't have much, you know. It's just whoever they could get who was like, yeah, sure, I'll sit down and talk about it for a second.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's funny because I remember Garrow's boss, I think, was dating somebody who worked in Hollywood. And a few months before this came out, the word was Paramount had seen a rough cut and was pissed off. Like, they were pissed off at what he delivered. Now, what he told Fangoria or one of those genre mags at the time is he claimed, oh, they gave me an additional $20 million to add more to it because they liked what they saw, which probably means they were trying to get reshoots to make it more presentable.
Right.
Because they'd already sunk money into it, but apparently they were very pissed off with what he had turned in.
Yeah,
it's an ugly, flat movie with the action. None of the action scenes are very good, and he's not an action director. He never was.
No, he never was.
One of the problems with Big Trouble in Little China, and I think one of the things that hurt it, you know, its playability in theaters, and he never acknowledges this. He didn't know how to shoot the fight scenes.
Yeah.
Like, they're very poorly shot. They're very poorly directed. They had really good choreographers. They're the best guys at L.A.
working on
that movie. Mm-hmm. And it was just like he didn't know how to shoot fight scenes, period. He just didn't know how to stage them.
Yeah.
Like,
that's one of those cases.
He doesn't know how to film stuff.
That's one of those cases where you just need Sammo hung on the set and go, okay, Sammo, you stage this.
Yeah, he should have brought in a Hong Kong second unit, but he was probably too arrogant for that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, his choreographer was Jeff Amata. Jeff Amata pretty much made a career out of lifting from Hong Kong movies anyway. So
yeah, Jeff Amata's in this movie.
Yes, he is. He's Saigon Shadow.
But this movie, you know, the next movie he did was Vampires, which was for Sony Pictures. Then Ghosts of Mars, Screen Gems, step down. And then 9 years later, he does The Ward, which is completely independent. So I think Hollywood was kind of done with him.
No, yeah. I think honestly, he was blackballed after Escape from New York.
Escape from New York?
No, I'm sorry, Escape from L.A.
Oh, I was gonna say, he's a few studio pictures in there.
Oh yeah, he got the green light. He jumped to the big studios because of Escape from New York. That showed he could do a large scale movie, and it made money. Like for Ivco Embassy, even though they got purchased by Norman Lear and then we're run out of the movie business for some reason. But Avco Embassy is a strange case of a studio that looks like it's about to get big. And then, well, I mean, it was big before because it's Joseph Levine's Embassy Pictures. You know, they released Hercules back in the 50s, and which was a huge hit. That was like the Star Wars of the 50s. But then as Avco Embassy, they're putting out all this genre stuff, and then they're bought by Norman Lear, and they're done.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's a nutty history. I gotta look it up. There's gotta be more to it than what I know. I just know kind of very superficial IMDb stuff about it, so I need to read up on what happened to them. But Escape from New York made him big with the studios, and Escape from LA, I think, got him kicked out of Hollywood in a way. Because Vampires came out in France something like 6 months before it was released in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I had a friend who was so excited about it. I think Columbia was involved in it. But I had a friend who was super stoked about it. He was like, oh, John Carpenter's Vampires is coming out. Vampires, you know.
I was excited. I was really excited.
That's one I haven't watched in a while. I always liked it because of James Woods, but I always thought it was kind of, we're in the diminishing turns territory with Carpenter by this point.
The problem with it is it has this amazing, sick, gory vampire massacre in the beginning where Thomas Ian Griffith's vampire comes in and just wipes out the crew.
Oh, it's so good.
Wipes out the vampire hunter squad and like only James Wood survives. And it's amazing. It's a really disturbing like action horror scene.
Oh yeah.
And then the rest of the movie is just a bunch of boring Peckinpah wannabe shit and
them
James
wandering
Woods,
around in the desert.
James Woods abusing a priest and making, you know, and Catholic bashing jokes and stuff, and it just gets like he has one good rant where he talks about what vampires really are, but the rest of it is just like Cheryl Lee. Yeah, she's like in bondage basically, and Daniel Baldwin's all fat and sweaty. And, you know. And then they're doing all these bullshit peck and paw macho postures and everything. And it's so fake. It's like, it doesn't work. It's really boring.
It's got our boy, you know who was in that though? Our boy, Chad Stahelski, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm sure he did a lot of the stunt stuff. Probably Thomas Ian Griffiths double. I think he's a tall dude. So like he doubled for Brandon in The Crow, like for a lot of the scenes where they CGI'd Brandon's face on him.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that. Chad is either wearing a Brandon Lee mask or they CGI'd his figure onto, you know, or his face onto Chad or something like that.
So, you know, John Carpenter stopped making movies after, I mean, The Ward is barely a movie.
No, it's not. It's not really a movie.
I almost don't even count it as a John Carpenter film, but, which is silly, but you know,
yeah.
Did he just stop making movies? Cause he's like, well, I'm just going to play video games and look at porn now. I don't know. Like,
yeah, watch basketball. He's real big on that.
I know he's still making music though. He just put out three records.
I was going to go see him. He was going to play at the Gothic Theater, not far from me. And I was going to go down and check it out, but the show got canceled. I guess advance tickets were bad or maybe he wasn't feeling healthy enough to play. I don't know.
I would imagine touring would be tough at his age.
Right, right. And he's always looked 50 years older than he was.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he looks like the Crypt, even in the 80s, he started to look like the Crypt Keeper with a cigarette.
Mm-hmm. And
not
yet
a healthy guy.
He was married to Adrienne Barbeau.
Yeah, well, he still looked like Jesse James back in 77 or whatever. You know, had the long hair and the mustache. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it was pretty funny. If you look at pictures of him before Halloween hit big, he's always wearing like denim and kind of dressing like a gunfighter or something, you know? And after Halloween hit big with the critics, and they were starting to call him like this intellectual, like, and Ronan Rowe pointed this out. He says suddenly he starts wearing black turtleneck sweaters, and you know he's photographed smoking a cigarette like a French intellectual and everything.
Yeah, well,
like
you look at any picture of him from then on, and he's dressed like that. Like, you know,
yeah, he's trying to do the smart guy. Oh, aren't I intelligent?
Steve Jobs. No, Steve Jobs. thing, but you know, like it's that look. Like Steve Jobs dressed like that because it send some message that you're a thinker.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I'm the thinking man, you know.
And isn't he producing the David Gordon Green, the terrible David Gordon Green Halloween movies?
I think he just takes a check for that. They cut him a check, and he also does the score, and he gets a big check for that just to have his name all over it, like he authorized.
But it's got him with Cody Carpenter and Daniel Davies. I kind of wonder how much of that is those guys.
Yeah, I mean, the odd thing is, like, I thought the last Halloween was so horrible, and it just went against everything he used to do.
And everyone loves it. Everybody loves that movie.
And I thought
it's garbage. So good.
Yeah, and it's like, it's no more, there are no sequels to Halloween. There's just these kind of alternate world sequels that are overcomplicate things and make it more than it needs to be. Like I rewatched Halloween before I watched this, or rewatched Escape from LA. And it's funny because I said, as far as I'm concerned, it's a standalone movie. It's very simple. Doesn't complicate anything. And the best stuff in it is when Michael is stalking them in the daytime.
Yeah.
That's the best stretch of the movie. It's amazing because it really gives you that slice of 70s Americana that's missing from all the sequels. Yeah. So all the sequels just want to get right to Michael walking up and popping somebody in the head and crushing their head like Jason and Friday the 13th or something. He's just a normal lunatic escaped from asylum, stalking them with a mask, and sometimes they see him, or they think they see him, maybe they don't. Or like when the kids are harassing the one kid who's going to be babysat by Laurie that night, and Tommy Jarvis, they have a name? Or is that
Tommy? I don't know. Tommy.
Yeah, we'll just say
whatever.
Tommy. But yeah, like he drops the pumpkin and the kids are kind of bullying him. And then one of the bullies runs off and runs right into Michael. And like that's actually, all of that is perfect.
Yeah.
It's like that's what's missing from the rest of these films. He's like super killer walking through the town just killing everybody. Well, if he's so friggin' invincible, why is he sneaking around?
Yeah.
Why don't they just line up the fucking National Guard and then he can just go through them like Godzilla or something?
And
you know?
But they also get bogged down in this lore, like, oh
yeah,
you know,
ooh, he's really her brother, and
he's her brother, and there's a cult of Michael cultists that are going to like use Michael's cousin to impregnate her and bring about the second Michael. Like they're gonna, the baby's gonna be Michael 2.0, and it's all this garbage.
Or Laurie Strode is Ripley.
Yes.
You know,
she's
Linda Hamilton in turn. No, in one movie she's Ripley, like Halloween H2O.
Yeah.
But in the last one, she's basically Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2. And it's just stupid.
Yeah, it's really dumb.
Wait a minute. According to the continuity they set up, Eric Zoliver actually pointed this out. They're going by the continuity that only the first movie has happened.
Right, right.
So
that
basically.
Was...
Michael is somebody who's killed about maybe four people, and she's acting like, you know, oh, I got to get ready for Rambo breaking out of prison.
Yeah, she's acting like, you know, she's acting like he's Michael Myers from the Rob Zombie.
Right, right. And it's like, oh, suddenly he's the guy who took out the entire hospital. And, you know, it doesn't make a damn bit of sense. And I think it's because that movie was reshot. Because according, I think Zolli said the whole damn thing was reshot, and some of the actors have kind of confirmed it. They said, I originally had a bigger part, but all the stuff I was filmed wasn't part of the reshoot.
Oh, so interesting. Like,
yeah. One of the guys who played the deputy says, I had a bigger role, but none of it's in there because I think they reshot it. And the word was they reshot it. You know, I think the first version they made was probably more like the first film, where Michael was more like the normal guy sneaking up on you. With the freaky retards.
Well, and I know David Gordon Green is an artsy director. If you've watched George Washington or movies like that, you know, he's kind of like Terrence Malick or something. You know?
Right. And I think what happened was the Akkad said, no, this needs major violence. You need to reshoot this.
You got
to
play the horror crowd. Yeah.
Right. And they reshot it to make it more like the Rob Zombie movies. And I think it's repulsively stupid.
Yeah. And these next ones are going to be bad.
I see the Halloween Kills trailer every time I go to the movies, and I'm just like, no, not seeing this bullshit. Yeah. And they don't have any faith in it anyway because it's going to premiere on Peacock the same day at the theaters. They already announced that. I said, oh, so it's a piece of shit, you know. But then I watched Escape from L.A. and. But I'm like, this doesn't even feel like the same director. Even though if I watch Escape from New York, I would say this feels like the same director. Escape from L.A., there's none of that atmosphere, none of that timing that he used to have. It's like Carpenter lost it.
Yeah, it feels like something's missing. I can feel a little bit of moments here and there. Like, I think the ending to this movie is super cool. I think it's really neat.
Supposedly all written by Kurt Russell.
Yeah, Kurt Russell is credited as a writer on this film, along with
Deborah
Hill.
Yeah, he came up with the ending, allegedly. Yeah. Deborah Hill was back, right, co-writing, which I thought would help, because I often wondered if she was the reason his earlier movies came off better.
Yeah, it's kind of like a
collaborator.
It's kind of like, what's her name, Polly Platt, or with Peter Bogdanovich.
Yeah, I think it's her name.
Yeah, she was his wife, and he cheated on her to get with Sybil Shepherd. But like those movies Bogdanovich did with her are really good, and then when they stopped working together, you know, those movies disappeared up their own butt, you know.
Right.
But there are other moments I like. I like the basketball scene. It's silly, but it's fun.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid. Yeah. The surfing scene's dumb as hell.
Oh, the surfing scene is so stupid, but I still there's something about it that I laugh every time.
It looks
I watch
like. You know what it looks like now? It looks like if SNL Digital Short did a spoof of Escape from New York and had Snake on a surfboard.
By the way, speaking of digital shorts, a great Norm MacDonald roast was he was sitting down with the Lonely Island. And they're like, hey, we're here with Norm MacDonald in the Lonely Island. He goes, yeah, hey, you know what I call the Lonely Island? Andy Samberg and the two other fellas.
Rest in peace, Norm.
I know. Oh gosh, that celebrity death hurts. Really does.
Yeah, There's been a lot of that. Belmondo hurt, even though he's an old man.
Yeah.
Sonny Chiba hurt, even though he was only 82 or something.
Yeah.
But Norm Macdonald really hurts because I feel like, you know, he had another 15, 20 years left.
Oh, yeah. Easily.
Really funny material because he was really the best of the late boomer comics. He was really the king.
Yeah. I loved it when he went on The View and called Bill Clinton a murderer.
Yeah, hey!
I think we need to get the homicide out of the White House.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton's a murderer, didn't she? I thought this was a matter of public record.
it's a fact. It's public record. It's a murder. Isn't he a murderer?
What? I love when he would go on late night shows and just toss a grenade.
Oh, yeah. He's great at that.
He's on Conan with this girl from Melrose Place, and she's about to be in that awful Carrot Top film, Chairman of the Board.
I saw that the day it aired and never forgot it. It's funny how that gets brought up all the time.
Because it's so good. He's like, you left Melrose Place? You left Melrose Place to go work with Carrot Top? He goes, what's the title? It's untitled. He goes, I got a title. Box Office Poison.
Yeah, she said Chairman of the Board. And he said, Board is spelled B-O-R-E-D. No,
they go, Chairman of the Board. And Conan goes, yeah, try to do something with that, you freak. And he goes, yeah. Board spelled B-O-R-E-D.
He's the best.
Oh, we didn't deserve him. And his O.J. Simpson compilations are just endlessly rewatchable.
Yeah, if you watch those, they're painfully funny.
Yeah. Oh, what was it? He was at the ESPYs, I guess that's ESPN's awards or something.
Yeah, they're a little
weird. He gets up there and he goes, some guy won the Heisman. He goes, you won the Heisman Trophy and nobody can take that away from you. Unless you murder your wife and a waiter. Ooh. Ooh.
Jeez.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he'd also make Michael Jackson as a pedophile joke.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder how Razor Fist felt about that.
Yeah, I know. Listen here, folks. Norm Macdonald was not as good as you might have thought.
I haven't checked that idiot's page, but, you know, I may have to now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bob Dole did a tribute to Norm. Who would have thought Bob Dole would outlive Norm Macdonald?
Oh, I know. I really thought Bob Dole was done. I thought he was dead.
I always forget he's still alive, you know.
It's weird. It's really odd. Should have been president in 96.
Bob Dole!
Yes. He was one of the last of those old school Republicans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. He was one of the older ones.
Before we got the, you know, the globalist lunatics,
the neocons. Yeah.
Yeah. Bill Kristol and all his twits.
Yeah.
But yeah. The thing about Escape from L.A. and I think it's just my thought immediately after I saw it first time was, why didn't we just get a different plot with Snake Plissken? Why isn't, let's see Snake Plissken as an outlaw criminal and, you know, pull on a heist or something. And I don't think Carpenter had that sort of inventiveness in him to do something like that.
Yeah. Doing a beat for beat remake that it feels like going through the motions a little bit.
It's lazy. It's really lazy.
I know that they've tried to do, there was like a comic that Marvel released and there were always rumors that there was going to be like an Escape from Earth or something. Do you know anything about that?
Escape from Earth ended up being rewritten as Escape from Mars, and that ended up being repurposed into Ghost of Mars.
Okay.
So he kept rewriting it. Basically, Ice Cube in Ghost of Mars is playing the Snake Plissken role after the fourth or fifth variation of the script.
I did not know that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it was repurposed and basically turned into, it was supposed to be the third Escape film.
You know what?
And he was prepping it. They thought it was going to be a hit because they thought, I think they were doing like the surveys and thinking, oh, how much do you want to see a sequel from Escape from New York? And they thought they might actually have a hit here, but you really can't do a sequel to something like, 13, 14 years later. You just can't.
No, it's very rare that that hits.
Right. It's just, it didn't make any sense why they'd even, you know, if you're going to do a sequel, do it as a standalone, different type of story. You know, he could have repurposed his, or rewritten his original Black Moon Rising script, with, had very little to do with the movie New World Pictures made in like 85, 86, that Harley Cochlis directed, that had led to Hamilton and Tommy Lee Jones. Apparently his script was about three Vietnam vets, and he wrote it for Charles Bronson, like with Charles Bronson in mind. It was three Vietnam vets who have their hot rod stolen or their car stolen by a corporation, and they break into this high-tech building to get their car back. Now, doesn't that sound more like a better Escape from New York type of sequel? He could have just rewritten that with Snake instead of, you know, those characters.
Yeah, that would have been a movie that worth seeing. And there's been a Escape from New York remake that's been in and out of, that's been in development hell forever. With you know, with like, there was going to have
Gerard Butler. Timothy Oliphant.
And, you know, there was that Escape Plan movie that Luc Besson made, and the people who have the rights to Escape from New York sued and won.
I think Carpenter sued him.
They might have.
Yeah, I think Carpenter still has the rights.
Well, there was talk of suing Hideo Kojima for the Metal Gear Solid games, because, you know, the main character is a guy with an eye patch named Snake in those games. And, you know, they definitely, he took that kind of infiltration plot lines with comic book characters, you know, over the top characters, and did it in video games. But apparently, John Carpenter put the kibosh on it, and because he was like, no, that Kojima's a good guy. Don't sue him.
Right. Well, yeah. To me, it's laughable that he sued Luc Besson, because it's like, Carpenter is one of the biggest thieves out there for films. Because if you think about it, something I realized when I watched The Enforcer for our show a couple of years back, Carpenter just stole Escape from New York from The Enforcer. Because The Enforcer, you have a group of radicals dressed up like the thugs that Escape from New York, kidnap the mayor of San Francisco, and hold them hostage on Alcatraz. And then Dirty Harry and his partner, Tyne Daly, they got to go infiltrate Alcatraz and get the mayor back and take out the gang. So that's what he did, was he just turned that into a science fiction movie. You know, he threw a little Damnation Alley in there, Roger Zelazny's novel, not the stupid movie. But it's like he put a little of that weird post-apocalypse futuristic world in there, and it's the same story, really.
Yeah.
He's a damn plagiarist.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I just realized that because I know he's a big fan of Dirty Harry movies, and he wanted to direct one, but you know, Eastwood doesn't want to pay like a director that costs money to direct a Dirty Harry movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but yeah, it's just like, I think he was so inspired by The Enforcer, he just took that plot and turned it into a science fiction movie.
Is there anything you like in Escape from L.A.?
I like Stacey Keach. I always like seeing Stacey Keach in anything.
Yep.
One of my favorite actors. I thought his performance is overall about as good as it's going to be. Mm-hmm. There's some funny stuff at the beginning about them choosing execution instead of being sent to L.A. Like, that got a big laugh in the theater.
That's
I thought that
funny.
Was funny stuff.
Yeah.
It's still funny, but when Snake and Cuervo Jones have that fight when he lands in the court and they end up fighting. They land in basically Disneyland, but they call it Happy Land. And they have that fight. I actually thought the choreography was interesting, but it's not shot or edited in a way that it's exciting.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
He does something to ruin the tension of that scene. I'm not
that
sure
entire final battle scene with the hang gliders. I don't think is executed well.
He can't shoot action. Carpenter cannot shoot action. He's not an action.
I've never thought of him as an action director.
Yeah, and he has that rep as one, but he's not an action director. It's strange.
It's funny when you said Escape from New York is it's an action movie shot like a horror film. Most horror movies have the opposite thing going
on. Yeah, nowadays all horror films are shot like action movies. They're loud and the editing's crazy, and you know, it's they probably employ as many more stuntmen than special effects people these days.
Yeah.
But, you know, you used to get a lot of really cool on-camera makeup effects, like from guys like Tom Savini and Tom Berman, whoever, and Mark Shostrom. That guy always did a lot of cool stuff for these types of movies.
Rob Bottin. Now
you don't have that. It's just now it's a nerd with a light pen just kind of drawing stuff and post-production. So the monsters look like paintings coming at you, and demons look like paintings, cartoons, you know. I mean, my eyes see that stuff as a cartoon. Like, when I went to see that Thing prequel.
Oh, yeah, I never saw that.
I was just like, well, I'm not, like, there's nothing scary about seeing these variations of the Thing because my eyes see it as a CGI. So it distances me from the effectiveness of it, where I could still jump in the original in Carpenter's The Thing, where the legs start popping out of the decapitated head and it becomes like a spider head.
It's disturbing.
Or when the stomach opens up and bites off the guy's hands. Like that still made me jump when I watched it years later.
And the guy's head dripping off and sprouting legs and running away. It's so gross.
And that's all on camera stuff done by Rob Bottin. And then I see this prequel, and arguably they're coming up with crazier stuff, but my eyes just see it as a CGI and I'm bored. Yeah. You know, it's just like I'm watching a cartoon, like I'm watching an anime of The Thing that happens to have live actors walking around talking to the cartoons.
Well,
like watching Rabbit.
I saw something on Twitter today that pissed me off. Speaking of this, some person with nothing better to do decided to go in to like Ray Harryhausen movies, and I'm going to smooth out the stop motion animation.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
No.
That is a executable offense because it makes it look less handmade, makes it look more artificial. It's still there. I'm still looking at it. But my goodness, the craftsmanship is what's so great. I don't need you to improve it for me. Thank you.
That's what kind of annoys me about the CGI'd Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, it's not as annoying as I thought it would be, but it's still kind of like I'd rather just watch the original.
Yeah,
versions.
It's you would think it would be, you know, a crime against art, but it's perfectly tolerable. Because the special effects are so non-existent, you know.
they didn't have much. It was a lot of suggestion and sound effects,
mm-hmm.
more than you realize, you know. But yeah, there's it's like the positive Escape from LA. You know, that about sums it up. I mean, look, Kurt Russell still looks like Snake Plissken. Just a couple of years later, he didn't age.
Yeah, he still looks the same. Yeah,
give him credit. The thing is, it's like, I was thinking about this today. Escape from New York, I saw it when I was 10. And maybe in many ways, I didn't realize Snake Plissken was a total imitation of the Clint Eastwood hero from the Spaghetti Westerns, because I hadn't really seen all of them at the time. And it's kind of like, okay, Snake is a 10-year-old's idea of a tough guy.
Absolutely. 100%.
To paraphrase Raymond Chandler, said it's a 13-year-old boy's idea of a tough guy. But that's what he is. And the problem here is, I guess because I saw it when I was older, suddenly I'm not as impressed with the character as I would have been, you know, if I were 10 and, you know, like I was when I watched Escape from New York. But
my parents, when they saw Escape from New York when it came out, and, you know, they're baby boomers, and they were like, we thought it was stupid, you know?
Yeah. Boomers didn't like the movie.
Yeah, they thought it was silly.
It was kids that liked the film. Kids who saw it on HBO or Cinemax saw it on there, and they're the ones that actually made it a cult hit. Boomers didn't like the film at all. It didn't. I think they were just weirded out by it, like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. My mom said she saw it because she liked Kurt Russell. So.
Right.
That was it. Yeah.
And it was supposedly the movie that broke him out of the Disney mold.
Oh, interesting. I guess he'd worked with Carpenter on Elvis, but that was just a TV movie, you know.
Right, and they had, what happened was, I think they originally offered Escape to Charles Bronson, who turned it down.
It's like, hey, and I'm not wearing an eye patch. You gotta go.
I ain't wearing the, what is this, science fiction? Who sees this stuff?
You put Jill Ireland in that role, or I'm going to put you out to lunch.
Jill Ireland had to play Maggie or something. But yeah, it was just like Bronson was probably like, hey, nobody will watch this science fiction stuff.
This mumbo jumbo. What, it's got Lee Van Cleef? I take dump spigot in him.
we were thinking like, Bronson worked with Robert Englund on St. Ives. And we were wondering if Robert Englund was asking Bronson for advice when he went to audition for Star Wars, which he was rejected for. He auditioned for Skywalker, and he went and told his roommate, Mark Hamill, hey, I think they're looking for somebody like you. You know, you ought to go try it, check it out.
And he went, but I was about to go down to the corner store and get some cigarette butts.
Did Bronson say to England, look, kid, don't do science fiction. It's weird. Nobody will go see this movie.
You should do
crime pictures.
You know what you should do, Robert? You should do a movie about a pedophile with knives for fingers.
Yes, do a horror film. People love to be scared. Their girlfriends jump in their laps when they're scared.
Hey, Robert.
Works every time.
I heard you're doing this movie about Freddy Krueger. Ask if you got a role for a hard-nosed cop to come and pop him.
He could have played Nancy's dad.
Yeah, he could have. He could have been
Krueger's
the judge. Fred
not real. Oh, you would have been great in that.
Yeah.
Go home, Nancy. Nancy, go home. I'm tired of this. I'm working late. I'm the sheriff.
I want Charles Bronson in more Wes Craven movies. I want him as the Swamp Thing. Carry Jill Ireland around.
I'm a plant now.
He plays the dad in Hills Have Eyes, except he kills the whole barbarian family.
This is just like the ghettos in our cities.
I left town to get away from this nonsense.
Yeah. It's like knocking Jupiter around. This ain't over.
This ain't.
It's like, you know, one of them's raping his daughter, and he's like, no dice. And no. He, like, you know, breaks his neck.
Ow. I just want every horror movie to have his character from 10 to Midnight show up.
Well, you don't. You notice those horror movies, they never have that alpha male like a Bronson type. They don't have like the cool war vet or the Green Beret or whatever can take all the killers out. Everybody's like a wuss or, you know,
the girl,
alpha is completely.
The girl's going to set some traps.
Right. And I think a lot of that came from Wes Craven having an option on First Blood. And I think he got obsessed with that part of the book. Because I notice he always has the girl setting traps.
Oh, yeah. That is a staple of the Wes Craven film is traps.
He loved his booby traps. He loved that gimmick.
People under the stairs and what's it called? Last House on the Left. And Hills Have Eyes 2 is full of that stuff.
Yeah, we don't think about it, but Wes Craven was a far more successful director than John Carpenter.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because let's bring up Wes Craven real quick. Another guy that's hard to believe is dead. You know, he popped with Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, he's doing low budget stuff like Hills Have Eyes and Deadly Blessing, Swamp Thing. I need to revisit Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I've got two different DVD versions. Or I got a Blu-ray and a DVD because I got the one with the Adrian Barbeau nudity that got pulled or deleted. Because I went out and bought it when the word of mouth got out that they'd accidentally released the R-rated cut from Europe.
Which release was this?
It was the original MGM DVD release. They completely screwed up, and they released the European version on the DVD.
Interesting.
And which had it had extra Adrian Barbeau nudity, and it also had two strippers at Arcane's party at his mansion.
Yeah, I think I've got the Shout Blu-ray of that one.
Yeah, some mom in Oklahoma discovered that when her kids rented it at Blockbuster, and a complaint was filed, and they realized they put out the wrong version. It was MGM's fuck up, truth is. You know, they should have put out the PG theatrical version, like it said on the package. But I don't know if the Shout version offers that
I'll have
version
to look. I can't remember. I own it, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I've never opened it. I bought it with, like, I traded a bunch of CDs and had a ton of credit, and got it because it's like, oh, I always, I guess, a childhood favorite. It's not a great movie, but I enjoy it more than a lot of Wes Craven's other movies.
But Wes Craven managed to stick around in the studios. You know, he never, you know, when he got to the big studios, he never really left. You know, he was working for Miramax at the end, but, you know, he was always, you know, working for Universal, Dimension, Paramount, you know, always.
They were always willing to work for him. Supposedly, Robert Evans had his heart attack before his death, his final heart attack. He was in the screening room with Wes Craven.
Oh, interesting.
I guess they were trying to make a deal with him or something. He started having his heart attack. I tell you, Wes, the suspense never stops around here. Or something like
Wes,
that.
Wes, this movie's really scary. I need you to get a doctor, Wes.
The total Robert Evans way, you know.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't think of Wes Craven as being that successful, but he was.
He was huge. Maybe the biggest name in horror, maybe bigger than Stephen
King.
Well,
his name was like Stephen King. When you saw Wes Craven, it was like that name. It's a good name for a horror director. Let's put it that way. The name has a ring to it. But, you know, speaking of 1996, that's the year Scream came out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that
and
John
boy,
Carpenter
don't
was,
you know, John Carpenter was like, why didn't I do a new Halloween movie?
I know. Yeah. Cause they did the movie that, hello, you want to talk about retreading Carpenter ground. That movie did it really well.
Yeah. It was like a tribute to Halloween. Half
yeah.
The time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They're watching Halloween in that one scene. Jamie Kennedy's like, oh, don't go in there. You know, Wes tried to break out of the horror mold though, when he did that Music of the Heart movie. Remember that?
Yeah. Nobody went to see it.
Nobody saw it.
Everybody wanted to see Meryl Streep get decapitated. I don't think they quite got that.
Yeah. Had Gloria Estefan in it. And Cloris Leachman, yeah. But yeah, that was the only time he tried to break out of that, but stuck around with it. But, you know. I remember he did that thriller Red Eye. Did you ever see that?
No, I never saw it.
It was solid. It was like a decent, like, you know, watch it and forget about it, but you know, didn't hate your time with it type thing.
Wasn't Rachel McAdams in that?
Yeah, she was. Her and
Killian I always thought she was gonna be a way bigger star than she was.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she's pretty, but I really thought she was gonna be huge after I saw Mean Girls and I guess The Notebook was real big with women and stuff, but I thought she was gonna be huge, and then nothing.
Yeah, she's gonna be in that Sam Raimi's Doctor Strange movie, it looks like.
Yeah, she was in Doctor Strange. You barely noticed, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I forgot she was in it.
Because, you know, I don't think the directors these days, like, they don't like girls. So, you know, they're not photographed in the best light. But, I guess I'll see her in that. But I thought, geez, she should be Sue Storm in the Fantastic Four or something goofy like that. And it's like, no, you never really didn't see her blow up big or anything.
Yeah, I'm looking at there's movies I've seen that I forgot she was in, like Sherlock Holmes.
She was in that?
Yeah, both of them.
Jeez, man, I've forgotten everything.
Yeah, she didn't have the career. Like, what was it? Her co-star in Mean Girls was, what's her face?
Lindsay Lohan?
Not Lindsay Lohan. She's fallen even further than that.
Oh yeah, she's like, you know,
what's that
a disaster.
Amanda Seyfried.
Yes.
She's in Mean Girls and she was one of the lesser characters, but she's kind of, her star's risen a little more, but I think she's kind of weird looking, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I remember her being a little bizarre looking, but I thought Rachel McAdams was going to be huge.
Yeah,
I think there was a controversy like she had lied about her age or something, or her agent had lied about her age.
Oh, I don't know about that.
There was something like that, like she was a little older than she claimed to be or something like that, which they all do. I mean, no matter who it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even men. I think Jason Statham has always claimed he's my age and he's actually like 5 or 6 years older.
Steven Spielberg lied about his age to make himself seem more like a Wonder Boy, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's like 90 now or something. I forget.
He's not that old. Steven Spielberg.
He's like 78.
He's in his 70s,
yeah, he's
probably.
70.
He's 74. Yeah, he's 74.
Okay,
70. He's like old boomer because he's 46. Yeah. Was when he was born. So,
And I think he was the first director to have that boomer aesthetic of
yeah.
obviously having watched a lot of TV in the 50s.
Yes, yes, for sure.
It's all over his stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know?
This sort of suburbia boomer dad thing.
Yeah, yeah. That's,
yeah.
A lot of people, when they talk about the suburbs in films, they kind of credit Spielberg as being one of the guys to really capture it first. You know, I don't know if that's
right.
true, but, you know, he really shot the suburbs.
Yeah, Carpenter was more like small town redneck that reads science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Magazines.
100%. Like that's what he was. He's from Kentucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was.
He'll always act like he was. He acts like he was alienated or something, like he was an outsider. Thing is, from the stories of him at UCLA when he was young, like all the women loved him because he like dressed like a cowboy.
Yeah.
You know?
He had the gunfighter mustache
and the long hair. And Dan O'Bannon hated him because he like, you know, felt like a wuss next to him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Dan O'Bannon was an angry guy. When I see interviews with Dan O'Bannon when he's older, he's got a bow tie. He seems very genteel. But when I watched a documentary about the making of Dark Star, it was like he seemed like a psycho.
Ron and Rowe told me that Dan O'Bannon drew like a pedophile underground comic strip.
Oh, goodness.
He was like, yo, John, don't feel bad for him. He's a total degenerate, you know?
Well, any other thoughts on Escape from L.A., John? What do you...
I think I've pretty much covered it. Do you have any special thoughts about this movie?
I think I like it more than you do because it takes me back to, you know, when I was pretty young.
Right.
But is it, I think the first Escape from New York is it's a lean, mean package. I watched it the other day. I think it's still awesome. Mm-hmm. But
great score, too. The music makes the move, hits the beats. It doesn't happen here.
And it's funny because when I posted about Escape from L.A., you know, whenever I watch Escape from L.A., John, I walk away from it because I think it has such a strong ending. I always walk away going, that was awesome. You know, that was pretty good. And then I think about it and I go, there's a lot that doesn't work. You know, it's kind of graded on a curve because if you end a movie well, you know, it kind of,
right.
You leave on an up note. But I think I like it a little more because of the 90s-ishness of it. I kind of like the thing I liked about it this time was, it portrays a very politically polarized America where it's like, crazies on one side over here and crazies on the other. And it does kind of make you go, oh yeah. Like it's kind of cool to see a guy like Snake just come in and burn it all down and walk away, you know?
Right.
So I really liked that. It has moments that I think are fun, even really stupid stuff, like the stuff with Peter Fonda. I like the basketball scene. I like the ending. There's one other scene that I like that I'm forgetting, but I like Stacy Keach, all the stuff leading up to that. But all in all, is it anywhere close to the original? No. It's not the movie it should have been, like you said, and... I think it's missing the tension of the original. A lot of the film is Snake in crowded LA areas, and it just doesn't. It doesn't have the suspense.
He doesn't stand out because he doesn't look unique.
Yeah, everybody's a freak there. So Snake doesn't.
Everybody's got long hair. Everybody's got. I think even Jeff Amata's Saigon Shadow has an eye patch or something. It's like everybody looks too similar to him. You know.
Yeah, it just doesn't work the way the original does. It's too populated. It's too busy.
Too clunky.
Yeah.
Too clunky. The way it's staged.
The effects don't hold up. Even though they do make it, that does add a little bit of 90s to it for me. So
they didn't hold up opening day. I can tell you that.
Yeah. Oh, I would actually think they play better now than they did then.
Yeah. Cause you can look at it as a joke.
Yeah.
Or whatever,
but back then it was
it's the Harryhausen motion blur.
Yeah. what would you rate this, John?
I give it like a 5. Hmm. Like, I don't hate it. I'm not gonna sit here like Stu and say shit. And I hate it. It's awful.
But you did say you thought it was okay.
It's okay. It's like it's a 5, but it just should have been so much better. And I know he likes to use that excuse and his apologists will use that excuse. It's El Dorado to Escape from New York's Rio Bravo. And it's like, yeah, Howard Hawks could get away with that back then because they didn't have VCRs.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't watch movies over and over and over again. They watched them on a TV broadcast once every five years.
Honestly, like, if you're sitting at home and you're going to watch a movie, are you going to watch Rio Bravo or are you going to watch Rio Lobo?
Yeah, or El Dorado.
Or El Dorado. Like, which one? Which one wins?
You're probably going to watch Rio Bravo.
Yeah, I mean, I might throw the other ones on when I get bored of that one, but, you know, that doesn't really happen because Rio Bravo is perfect.
The only people that tell you they prefer El Dorado is because they burned out on Rio Bravo.
Yeah, of course.
Because it was so awesome. They watched it repeatedly. Well, then they started watching El Dorado because they hadn't seen it as much.
It's the same phenomenon that happens with us with The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, where we go, you know what? These others are better, but it's just because we haven't watched them as much.
Right. Or Fistful of Dynamite. I've always said I'd rather watch Duck, You Sucker than Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's because I haven't watched it more than maybe four times.
Yeah. Yeah. I've only
seen
it.
Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I've seen multiple times. I saw it at Harvard Film Archives. I saw it at the Stars Film Center on the big screen. Yeah. You know? It's like I've seen it so many times. It's just like I don't have to watch it again. You know, I can sell off my Blu-ray and not care. You know, I just don't. I don't need to sit through it. But, you know, I got to let my kid watch it and everything.
Mm hmm. Well, I would give it a 6, 6 out of 10. I think it's aight, but, you know, I'm going to watch Escape from New York again before I watch this again, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of made it clear, talking about tonight, I think this is the movie that got him kicked out of Hollywood pretty much.
And I think, you know, I don't know about you, but when do you think Carpenter started to lose his touch? Because I think his last great movie was In the Mouth of Madness. Because I think Village of the Damned is the only movie of his I think I don't own. Because I saw it once and I thought it was bad. I think he kind of falls off after In the Mouth of Madness.
I'm going to take some heat for this, but I'm going to say They Live.
Ooh! Hot take! Yeah. Hot take alert!
Yeah, okay. hot take. Hot edgy take
okay,
here.
Okay, but John, I will say, you know, somebody asked me, you know, what are your 10 out of 10 Carpenter movies? And I said, you know, Halloween... Big Trouble in Little China, which, you know, not really a 10 out of 10, but whatever. I said In the Mouth of Madness, and someone goes, what about They Live? And I said, yeah, that movie takes forever to get started.
It does.
You know, that movie.
It really does.
I remember the first time I saw it, I went, when does this get good? I was sitting there, like, getting ants in my pants because I was so bored. And then
everybody remembers 2 to 3 great scenes in that movie. The problem is they don't remember the rest of the film.
Because those scenes are so awesome, that becomes all you think about, you know?
Exactly. The put on the glasses the first time is really cool. The alley fight between Piper and Keith David is great.
And I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum.
Yes. Everybody remembers those scenes. The rest of the movie is a chore. It just is. It's great for memes. It's great for South Park episodes spoofing it. It's really awesome for memes. So I say it's good for memes. You get to see Roddy Piper could have been, I think, a theatrical movie star had he had the right roles lined up after that. Because he's very natural on camera. He's a good on-camera tough guy. Absolutely. That's more of the tough guy they need to find for movies than... You know, these, you know, senators' grandnephews that are getting promoted as action stars.
All these people are blue blood, like elites that are just handed careers.
They've never,
so disgusting.
Got their hands. They're no John Paul Belmondo.
No.
Having boxed 30 professional fights and served in Algeria. They're not real men. Nope. But, you know, they don't smoke cigars and drink booze and screw Ursula Andress off camera. But, yeah, they don't even like girls, but it's the last you'll ever see of that kind of earthy stone male type of star that they could have had. But They Live is really, really clumsy. Everybody just has that, like this movie, Escape from LA has a lot of similar issues with the pacing and everything.
What about Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
That was after.
So I know. I'm just saying.
You know, I've seen it once, and I don't remember much about it.
I saw it once, and I liked it. I thought it was fun.
Yeah. I didn't hate it or anything. No. I just thought, well, it's just kind of there. It's a little odd.
You could tell
it's Chevy Chase being filmed in scope.
Yeah, you know? And you can tell him and John Carpenter don't get along, you know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And well, another thing is, and this is something about Carpenter that I'm gonna have to get off my chest on this show.
Oh.
John Carpenter in the late 70s, the way Tarantino was pushed on millennials as this is the filmmaker, the up-and-coming filmmaker that's the auteur that you need to follow, and you read all his interviews and you listen to everything he says and he turns you on to the old movies and and such. Carpenter was sort of that for Gen X.
Interesting.
And that's because he would do all these interviews with every genre mag. Starlog would have interviews with them, and Fangoria would have interviews, and Famous Monsters and Cine Fantastique. And he was a good talker. He could really talk because he could talk film history and his own ideas about film and everything, and how much he loved using Panavision or scope and shooting in, you know, scope format or whatever. And talking about music and everything. And he would do a lot. You could find a lot of John Carpenter interviews from the 70s and 80s. And he was just great at speaking this stuff. And, you know, he shacked up with Adrian Barbeau. So he was like that auteur movie hero for Gen X. And that's why you see a lot of, you know, and he wasn't a square goody two shoes like Steven Spielberg was perceived to be. You know, he wasn't going to make something like E.T. So, and, you know, instead of praising artsy directors or John Ford, he would praise Clint Eastwood before that was trendy. And he would praise
Howard Hawks,
you know, Howard Hawks. He wanted to be Howard Hawks so bad. It was something else. And he seemed cooler than Brian De Palma. And he seemed a lot, you know, like I said, he was not the goody two shoes Steven Spielberg was. And he wasn't as nerdy as Joe Dante. So he just came off like that was Mr. Cool. Mr. Cool movie guy. And that was all gone by like 1989. Mm-hmm. It just vaporized. It's because he actually had very few hits in the 80s. Like,
yeah.
The Thing was a flop.
Yep.
Starman did well.
Starman got Oscar nominations, didn't it?
Yeah, that was probably his most successful film after Halloween, I think.
But Big Trouble flopped. You know, I can't imagine people going to see Prince of Darkness.
Now they didn't, and I've been told that's his most underappreciated movie that's really good.
I like it because it's weird, but it's...
Yeah,
it's
made a Lucio Fulci movie.
Yeah.
He basically made a Fulci movie, but he didn't admit it, but that's what he did. You know?
And
like,
in the
but
mouth,
I need to see it again. I want to revisit it.
Yeah, I need to revisit it too. In the Mouth of Madness is one that I like quite a bit because it's just so surreal and crazy.
I like that until the end.
Mm.
I honestly think that might have been the first Carpenter I saw in a theater.
Interesting.
Because he was one of those directors. His stuff would be gone from the theater so quick, you'd see it on video.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah. You know, a lot of, and I didn't want to see Starman when I was that age because it looked too... it looked like he was trying to be Spielberg.
Yeah,
like
I was going to say that's his E.T. right there.
Yeah, too goody two-shoes.
That's him going, oh, you don't like The Thing? Well, here's an alien movie you'll like.
Yeah, and I was too young to see Halloween and... Escape from New York and The Thing in a theater. So, you know, my parents weren't going to take me to that stuff.
But,
so.
You know, and you said he was Mr. Cool Movie Guy. You know, he's a one regularly cited by Gen X directors like Robert Rodriguez. You know, he wants to be John Carpenter.
Yeah, he does. I think he wanted Carpenter to score Planet Terror.
Yeah. And he's why Rodriguez, who is no John Carpenter in this regard, but he scores his own movies because he wants to be like John Carpenter.
Yeah. Exactly.
Carpenter's scores are good though, but Rodriguez, all he does is take an electric guitar and go, wow.
Yeah, he does a bunch of Dick Gale and guitar riffs and
he goes to Tarantino for Kill Bill 2 and he's like, oh, you know, let me make a score for you. And all it is like, wow.
Yeah.
And I was going, really? This did this add a lot to the film to have you strumming on the guitar?
His ego won't allow for anything else. But,
he could have gotten some stings. Cool, you know.
Yeah. Well, the the coolest story I heard is Romero, when he made Land of the Dead for Universal, he wanted Carpenter to score the film, and Universal said no. They were not going to work with John. They were not going to work with John Carpenter.
So yeah, I guess you're right. He was just totally blackballed.
Yeah, and this is what 2007, 2006 when that movie was came out. Maybe
they'll put his name on a Halloween movie to give it cred for the horror community, though.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally. They have to. You know, it's essential. Like, that you need his name to sell Halloween to the public. But yeah, Romero wanted to use Carpenter to score his film, which would have helped it a little bit, I think. Although yeah. It's still not very good.
No. Land of the Dead, that's one of those movies every few years. I go, like, every 5 years maybe, I go, Land of the Dead, I should watch that again. And then I watch and I go, oh, yeah. You know?
That's when I started purging my shelves. Yeah, I watch Land of the Dead, and I go, I don't need this.
Man, it's one of those movies I really want to like. Like, I really want to love it every time I watch it, and it's just not quite there. I like seeing Dennis Hopper. I like this and that, but it doesn't quite get there. It's
first Romero I saw in a theater.
Me too.
Just like Carpenter, his movies would be gone from theaters before I could see them.
And that was because the zombie craze came back, so they threw all this money at Romero, and, you know. Actually, Survival of the Dead was probably his best later.
It was
zombie movie.
I think it's better than Day of the Dead, which I never liked. So.
Day of the Dead is always that always felt like a low budget chamber piece.
Fans love it because it's anti Reagan, and they like it because it's anti military, and because all the movie is military people picking on these leftists who, you know, want to study the zombies or whatever the hell they want to do. Mm-hmm. Or go to an island and smoke weed and listen to reggae music.
Yeah.
Because and you get a decent zombie massacre, but boy, it doesn't mean anything now because, you know, The Walking Dead, AMC let that show get away without doing that stuff every week.
Everybody is always like, oh, you watch Walking Dead? I go, look, I think I saw every zombie movie ever made up until that show came out, and when I saw the first episode, it was every trope, and I was just sick of it.
Yes, it was. You didn't get all smarmy and go, I liked it better when it was called Dawn of the Dead.
No, I don't do that because I don't like coming off as the movie guy who's better than you. Like, I don't like being comic book guy from The Simpsons. You know?
And it was called Night of the Living Dead.
I don't want to be that guy, but I just go, look, you know, I've seen every plot on The Walking Dead spun out 1500 different ways. Nothing that show can do could possibly surprise me or interest me because I've seen it all.
I watched the first season. It was every Romero trope over and over again, except done TV style.
I watched the first episode and I was like, okay, this isn't really grabbing me. I started the second episode, and I think when Michael Rooker showed up, I was like, I can't do this.
That actually, he was the character that drove me off from it.
Yeah, I just like his. He's so annoying. I like Michael Rooker, but he's so annoying in this. He seems like.
Well, they just said be a hateful redneck. Okay.
Yeah, he felt like a character from Day of the Dead. You know.
Yeah. Yes. When's he gonna start doing locker room threats to a girl in this show? You know? Yeah. I think he did. You know?
Yeah, I think. Oh, I'm sure he did. Yeah. Oh, Romero though. He and Craven, man. So many of these guys are gone. You know.
Yeah, these are the guys I grew up, you know, watching their stuff on VHS and cable TV and admiring and thinking, oh man, they're really gonna blow me away when they finally get this freedom they want, man.
Oh, yeah.
And no,
oh,
they
man.
Never. No, yeah. No, I was kind of wrong with that.
Yeah,
I think Craven actually had the best later career comeback with Scream. I mean, he probably in many ways it's probably the best thing he did.
When the rest of Yeah, you know, the rest of his contemporaries were falling off by that point, you know, and he really had a mega resurgence with that film.
And that thing had Scream was a word of mouth. It was in theaters for almost a year.
Yeah.
It was word of mouth. I the last time I've seen a movie get that type of reaction.
Yeah. And
you got to go see this, and people are still seeing it. 6 months later.
And I was in and I was a little kid and everybody was talking about it. Like, oh, Scream, you know, so scary.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like.
And funny.
In many ways, that was his great. He made the one postmodern satire of that stuff that worked.
Yeah.
Because it was still intense and still bloody and you know, I haven't seen it since the 90s, but
well,
I'm sure it
a lot of great. The horror movies that are talking about horror movies are a dime a dozen these days. But that one works because every other kind of spoof horror film is distancing itself from the genre, so it doesn't so it can avoid criticism of not being scary. Scream is a spoof of the genre and it totally embraces it and goes for it. And you, if you watch that as a straight horror movie, it works. If you watch it as a comedy, it works. It's really good.
Yeah, I watched Scream 4 a couple of weeks ago. A movie I did not know existed until I think you mentioned it on here or something. I just suddenly realized the movie existed.
It was his
like,
last
when
film.
I was a dad, I just when I had a kid, I kind of forgot about what was playing in theaters and didn't really keep up.
Of course.
And I had also sworn off horror movies.
Right. Right.
So, and because I just don't care. I don't like new horror at all. But I watched it on Stars about a month ago, and it wasn't bad. And I was a little surprised. He kept some of that edginess that I didn't think they allowed in movies anymore. Like the one of the screaming face killers basically threatened to rape one of the victims. And I was a little surprised. I didn't expect to hear that type of dialogue in these movies these days.
Yeah.
So it kind of keeps the violence, and he was keeping the tension level real because he has daughters. He knows what scares girls.
Mm-hmm. Well, he listened to them.
He does. That's why his female characters. I mean, he's not good with actors. The performances are terrible in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
But the girl characters don't feel cliched or fake. You know.
Mm-mm.
Yeah,
no.
But that was one thing I realized. Both he and Carpenter are actually pretty bad with actors.
Yeah, that's true. They kind of rely on their charisma.
Right, right. They're not interested in, I don't think they know how to work with actors. I think they more or less, they're thinking more about setting up that shot to be intense or suspenseful.
Yeah, they're thinking about the bigger picture,
the jump scare, the look of it, the atmosphere. They're just not actors, directors, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Really interesting generation. And it's kind of
I should say David Arquette and Courtney Cox come off great in the Scream movies because they don't need direction. Like, they're experienced actors that, okay, I know how to run with this.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Whereas Nev Campbell is a ghost.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well, anything else to add before we go, John?
Nah, that's it. I think we've gone through Carpenter enough to piss everybody off.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Everybody's going to there's something to make you mad in this episode. Everybody mad, really.
Well, we got to debunk some of the legend stuff that gets repeated that
nobody
really takes apart. I think that's part of our show is we kind of take apart the
narrative.
Images people have. The narrative that people have of this stuff that's not really justified.
Next,
when you look into it, you could really pull the legs out from under it, you know.
Next, we're going to examine the career of Steve Miner next time.
Everybody's favorite horror director, Steve Miner.
Yeah,
Steve Miner has directed 15 movies. Name one.
Oh man, yeah. I bet people who were like, oh yeah, you know, we were like, ooh, let's go see House, the new film from the director of Friday the 13th Part 2 and 3.
Is the director of Lake Placid?
And you know what he did right after House? Soul Man with C. Thomas Howell.
We also did the Wonder Years pilot. I think he's actually the guy who developed
I didn't know that.
That's probably his big claim to fame. Here's the funny thing about Steve Miner. I guess we'll have to extend this. Steve Miner, unlike Wes Craven and unlike John Carpenter, is actually great with actors.
Acting.
Watch Friday the 13th Part 2. Those characters, I don't think it's a good movie, but those characters come off great.
Acting is solid in that film.
They feel like real teenagers.
Yeah, they do.
You know? And Wonder Years, like, you can't argue that, like, those people did their best on that show. And,
mm-hmm.
like, he is good with actors. Lake Placid is not a very good movie at all, but the acting's fun. The actors are having fun. Obviously, he knows how to get good performances out of people. And he came from the same East Coast company as Wes Craven.
Yeah, he worked on Last House on the Left. Mm-hmm. And what's funny about Steve Miner, though, is that he was one of these guys who started out in horror and managed to break out.
Yeah.
You know, he did a lot of non-horror movies like Forever Young, My Father the Hero, Big Bully. Then he returned to the genre for a bit.
For H2O.
Mm-hmm.
And H2O, Lake Placid. H2O is terrible.
He did the Day of the Dead remake, which everyone hated.
I forgot he did that. I never saw it.
Never, me neither. It was just so hated. But you can't tell with these things if it's just purity. Like, oh, yeah. You can't touch that. His last movie was Private Valentine, Blonde and Dangerous, starring Jessica Simpson.
What a way to go out.
Yeah, I know. Steve, you got to get, like, bring House back or something. Do something, you know.
They should have him reboot Friday the 13th.
They should. Oh, that would...
Give Victor Miller $10 million, tell him to go away, and then just do a cheap one for like $3 million and bring in Steve Miner and use non-union actors and wham.
Boom. Boom. And don't let Jason Blum produce it.
Yeah, don't let Blumhouse near the shit.
All right. Anyway, the Steve Miner bonus episode at the end, right there.
Yes.
All right, everybody, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. And hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. And find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.